Jumia Abu Jamal from Imprisoned Nation. You're listening to listener-sponsored KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. KPFK, powered by the people.
Omar El-Akkad's new book, One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against Us, is a powerful and penetrating examination of the bankrupt morality of industrialized nations, especially the United States, which have sustained the genocide against Palestinians and justified it with racist tropes and lies. He exposes in his book our innate barbarity, our cloying hypocrisy, our latent racism, our narcissistic self-adulation, our demented belief, embraced by liberals and conservatives, that we have the right to impose our supposed virtues on the quote-unquote lesser breeds of the earth we subjugate and exploit with campaigns of industrial violence, whether in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, or Palestine. Omar, who was born in Egypt, grew up in Qatar. He moved to Canada as a teenager and currently lives in the United States. He is a two-time winner of both the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Award and the Oregon Book Award. His books have been translated into 13 languages. His debut novel, American War, was named by the BBC as one of the 100 novels that shaped our world. Joining me to discuss One Day Everyone Will Have Been Against This is Omar El-Akkad. I loved your book. I read it all in one sitting. I'm going to begin right at the beginning. You talk about language. You do that a lot about your book. I'm just going to read this passage and then have you comment on it. Language, too, forces the air from the lungs. Beyond the high walls and barbed wire and checkpoints that pen this place, there is the empire, and the empire as well is cocooned inside its own fortress of language, a language through the prism of which buildings are never destroyed, but rather spontaneously combust, in which blasts come and go like Chinooks over the mountain, and people are killed as though to be killed is the only natural and rightful ordering of their existence, as though living was an aberration, and this language might protect the empire's most bloodthirsty fringe, but the fringe has no use for linguistic malpractice. It is instead the middle, the liberal, well-meaning, easily upset middle, that desperately needs the protection this kind of language provides, because it is the middle of the empire that must look upon this and say, yes, this is tragic, but necessary, because the alternative is barbarism, the alternative to the countless killed and maimed and orphaned and left without home, without school, without hospital, and the screaming from under the rubble, and the corpses disposed of by vultures and dogs and days-old babies left to scream and starve is barbarism. And I, just as a caveat, you and I ran straight into this buzzsaw when we were supposed to do an event together, and the organizers refused to allow us to use the word genocide in the description of the talk. But you make this point, I think, very presciently about language and the way it serves as a kind of buffer or a mask from reality, especially vis-a-vis, but not explicitly, not only, but vis-a-vis this genocide. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me, first of all. I really, really appreciate it. I've been a longtime reader of your work. A very long time ago, I was reporting in Guantanamo Bay, in the prison camps there, and they were giving us a tour of the place, and I asked a question. I asked something like, you know, so when do the prisoners... And when I got to that word, one of the soldiers stopped me and said, "We don't have prisoners here, sir. We have detainees." And it was very, very important to that person's worldview that there be no prisoners here, because a prisoner implies a prison sentence, which somebody has to define at some point. A detainee you can hold forever. There were no interrogations at Guantanamo Bay. Of course, people were interrogated left, right, and center. They just didn't call it that. They called them reservations, as in detainee 8692 has an 8:30 p.m. reservation. It means they were going to be taken into the interrogation shacks. I did far, far less war reporting than you did. I did very, very brief stints But one of the things they sort of informed in terms of my worldview is that the physical layer of violence in wartime, or in what might be described as peacetime, even though it isn't, can't stand in a vacuum. It can't stand on its own. It needs other layers holding it up. And one of those layers is linguistic violence, euphemistic violence, the violence of calling a thing something other than what it is. Collateral damage instead of, oops, we bombed a wedding party. And that you see, I mean, in varying degrees of intensity, particularly over the last 25 years or so, but in the last year and change, it's had this almost numbing quality to it, where it's not just the general from the invading army telling you this. It's the anchor on the nightly news describing a little girl as a young lady who collided with a bullet. What the hell does any of that mean, right? But it's necessary, because fundamentally what you're trying to do is not represent the situation as it is. What you're trying to do is give someone on the other side of the planet who has the privilege of looking away the language with which to look away without feeling a pang in their conscience. All of this essentially works the moment somebody in the privileged side of the world is able to say, yeah, that's all so complicated, and turn away from it. That's all they're being asked to do, and this is the language that facilitates that.
Well, it also, even though the images are there, when you adopt this kind of false metaphor to describe it, it drains it of its atrocity in some sense, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that's, otherwise it wouldn't have its power. I mean, the distance that you can impose with this kind of language is so modular. You end up in a situation where you can apply this language to anybody whose presence, whose existence is inconvenient to the project. And I mean, we're going to see this, right? We're going to see this with the language being used by the government of the United States with regards to migrants over the next 4 years is going to use the same kind of anesthetic language. And it's almost the employment of language for the exact opposite of what language is supposed to do. There's supposed to be some concern with precision here, with using the word that most closely describes the thing. And this is the exact opposite of that. And it cannot be said to be done accidentally. This is an incredibly deliberate kind of linguistic malpractice. And overwhelmingly, it works. Overwhelmingly. You call someone an enemy combatant, and who the hell wants to stand up for an enemy combatant? Who wants to be that person? You call someone a terrorist after the fact, they're dead, they can't defend themselves. Maybe they were a terrorist. Maybe they were this incredibly evil person. I don't want my reputation to be destroyed standing up for a kind of person like that. So overwhelmingly, all evidence is that this kind of thing works. And so I can fully understand why institutions of all kinds, not just the military, not just the government, would rely on this. It's the fastest way to avoid dealing with something that would otherwise make very privileged people very uncomfortable.
Well, it shuts down any ability to give any situation any context. So I debated Christopher Hitchens on his ridiculous book, God Is Not Great, at Berkeley, and in the middle of it, he starts shouting at me, shame on you for defending suicide bombers, which, of course, I've never done and didn't even do in the debate. But it becomes, if there is no context, then whatever happens, like on October 7th, becomes not only incomprehensible, but the people who carry out something like that after 16 years of being locked in a concentration camp, they become incomprehensible.
I mean, I think a big part of this, a necessary component of the world as it exists today that would allow something like this to happen, by which I mean not only the genocide of the last year and change, but 3/4 of a century of occupation at the very least, is a kind of imaginative poverty, which is to say, that kind of accusation and accusations like it You want to kill all Israelis. You are a terrorism supporter. All of this sort of stuff, I think, makes perfect sense if you believe in a world where there are only two options. You are either wearing the boot or you're having your neck stepped on. And so to speak up on behalf of anybody who's having their neck stepped on is immediately assumed to mean, oh, you want to step on my neck. Those are the only sort of worldviews that are acceptable under that ordering of the world. And it's disastrous, if you know, because the obligations put on somebody who's trying to imagine a better world are unlimited. If you and I both want something better than this, I guarantee you within 5 minutes of talking about it, we will have some kind of disagreement as to what better looks like, because the imaginative obligations placed on us are infinite. Somebody who is served by the system doesn't have to imagine anything else, and so can safely live within the confines of this fantasy where, yes, either these people will be killed or those people will be killed. Either this genocide happens this way or an even worse genocide is going to happen. And it is such imaginative poverty. And it's applicable to virtually every facet of life under an empire. It has to be this way because somebody has to do the killing and may as well be us.
I think one of the things that gives your book such power, you're a beautiful writer, first of all, but one of the things that gives your book power is that even though, of course, your English is, you know, not only fluent, but highly literate, you nevertheless are seen by the wider society as an outsider. And you talk early on in the book about an experience of with your father. He gets, I think he's working in Cairo, and he gets stopped by the police. And, you know, but for the intervention of somebody who knows him, he could have been hauled off to an Egyptian prison. This was in Egypt. And you write about that that memory. You said, you know, which you come back, you said you come back to it often. And then you write, rules, conventions, morals, reality exist. All exists so long as their existence is convenient to the preservation of power. Otherwise, they, like all else, are expendable. And that small incident with your father and that observation is just, of course, writ large with the breakdown of any kind of even pretense about a rules-based order and the genocide in Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, that moment, I think, was one of those that you know, long before I showed up or had any kind of agency, altered the trajectory of my life, because my father loved Egypt. I mean, he grew up there. He, I don't think, ever imagined leaving that country. It was home for him. And still, he had to get the hell out. And so the sort of defining way in which that has altered my life is that I'm relatively unrooted. There is no geography, certainly no nation state that I can point to and say, this is mine. And that'll never be the case for me for the rest of my life. One of the things I find really interesting in people's sort of perception of me is that it varies wildly depending on which facet of my identity they decide to latch onto first. So if it's my name or my religion, that's a very different person they believe they're talking to. Whereas if it's this accent, where I could call you up and tell you my name was John Smith and you'd probably believe me, that's an entirely different person they believe they're talking to. Or if it's the books and so on and so forth. And so it's not so much existence as something lesser, which appears in sort of brief moments, a lot of go back where you came from, or, you know, that sort of thing. And I had my fair share of that. I mean, I was a journalist. I was a full-time journalist in the peak of the internet comments era when newspaper websites used to leave those comments on. So I've certainly seen my fair share of that kind of thing, and it doesn't trouble me at all. It is relatively meaningless. The more sort of pervasive mode of existing in this part of the world is preemptively preparing for which version of my phantom self this person is going to latch onto, and trying to put them at ease. So this is a very silly example, but you go through security at an airport, for example, and for the longest time, because I'm perpetually terrified of that interaction, even though it's never gone wrong for me, I would walk in and it would be yes, sir, no, sir, and very sort of polite. And then I realized over time, empirically, that I was having an easier time if I was much more casual, because that's what the people who are from here are, that's the way they're behaving. And so you sort of build up this kind of cultural survival kit that you keep in your back pocket. And most of the time, it's not a huge deal at all. It's just how you get through the day. But the cumulative effect of it is such that you are made cognizant of an entire spectrum of dealing with institutions of power and with the load-bearing beams of a society that folks who do feel rooted to that society never really think about. It's a kind of shadow world that some of us inhabit and some of us don't know exists. I've come to terms with that, but all of that traces back to that one day when a soldier working for the Egyptian regime decided to give my dad a hard time, and my dad realized that there was no rationality. You could be in the right, you could have done nothing wrong, and it wouldn't matter in the slightest because somebody with some modicum of power has decided that today's your day.
Well, it may not have happened to you, but it happened to your father. He was denied entry to the United States. He was, because of a similar kind of name, he was even profiled. So as a child, you did watch this happen.
Yeah, and I mean, I've seen relatives of mine who have similar names, who look the same, but who don't have this accent, get treated entirely different. You know, for a very long time, I think I thought of this in, I was very proud of myself that I had become this person, that I had become fluent in this language, in this culture, that I could maintain a conversation with somebody and they wouldn't even know that I wasn't from here, you know, that sort of thing. Precisely because I'd seen what happened to people who didn't have that, who are much better human beings than me, but who are regularly dragged into secondary because there's this distance. There's this implied otherness. And a lot of my life, I'm not particularly proud to say this, but a lot of my life has been about causing myself as few headaches as possible by adopting whatever it takes to close that distance, to say to somebody, hey, don't be scared. I'm like you. I get this. I'm not far away. And the worst part about it is that empirically, it has worked. It has proven wildly successful for me. And the proof is, you know, among many other examples, my relatives who don't have this and have seen a much darker side of daily interactions than I regularly do.
I want to talk about this, the hallmarks of Western liberalism. You write, it is an assumption in hindsight of virtuous resistance as the only polite expectation of people on the receiving end of colonialism. While the terrible thing is happening, while the land is being stolen and the natives still being killed, any form of opposition is terroristic and must be crushed for the sake of civilization. But decades, centuries later, when enough of the land has been stolen and enough of the natives killed, it is safe enough to venerate resistance in hindsight. And of course, what you are talking about, you know, now that it's over, we can you know, talk about ceded land, and which we have no intention of giving back, or the ethic of indigenous peoples, etc., now that they've been exterminated. But of course, this applies directly to what's happening to the Palestinians at this moment.
Yeah, I mean, I a long time ago, I was at a literary festival up in Canada, and literary festivals in Canada started with land acknowledgments well before U.S. Festivals started doing the same. And we were sitting there, we were about to start our event, and one of the organizers gets up and says, just before we begin, you know, I just want to, you know, take this time to acknowledge the really important acknowledgement that we are on unceded indigenous territory, and to also thank the hedge fund that is sponsoring this event.
Yeah, right.
And I was like, this is the most honest land acknowledgement I've ever heard, you know?
Right.
I think of it, particularly this idea of after the fact acknowledgement, as, and maybe this is particularly cynical of me, but I think of it as a continuation of theft. You steal land, you steal lives, And what's left to steal at the end but a narrative? The narrative that absolves all that came before. You know, when I wrote the title of this book, when I was first thinking about it, I wasn't thinking in terms of weeks or even years. I was thinking, if I'm fortunate enough to live the average lifespan in this part of the world, maybe by the end of my life, I'll be watching a poetry reading in Tel Aviv that begins with a land acknowledgement. I think it's a fundamental part of any system of endless taking, which, you know, colonialism and whatever stage of capitalism we're in are fundamentally part of. There are very few systems as well versed in after the fact shame and after the fact guilt as the ones that are predicated on endless taking. And you see it all over the place. I mean, there's an incredible poetry collection by Layli Long Soldier called Whereas, which is all about sort of repurposing and undermining a U.S. government declaration that basically said, sorry about all that genocide, indigenous people, sorry about the theft. And it was passed in the most sort of bland manner, hundreds of years after the fact. And that is such an important part of the entire project. We can all be sorry afterwards. The taking happens now and the apology comes later. It's a hallmark of every colonial society. The thing that makes it so dangerous to acknowledge right now is that we're not after the fact. We're in the middle of the fact. And so the people who disagree with the content of this book or with the assertion of that title are going to disagree vehemently until one day they don't have to. And then they're going to acknowledge it and there will be no repercussions. And we can sit around and listen to a very flowery land acknowledgement when it's too late to do anything about it.
Right. At Jared Kushner's resort in northern Gaza. I want to talk about this point you make. You talk about this moment in Qatar where you lived as a boy, and of course I've been in Qatar twice in the last few months, and much of the labor is performed by South Asians, Southeast Asian, you witness a small traffic accident, and the Southeast Asian man is I'd beaten with a sandal or something. But anyway, you talk about non-existence. Non-existence is necessary to the self-conception of this place. Qatar is hardly exclusive to this. Think of undocumented workers here. And how uncontrollable is the rage whenever the non-existence is violated. Talk about that, how we live in the midst of it. Undocumented workers all around us essentially occupy that position.
Yeah, and I should say here that a lot of this book, I mean, I think it comes in through the door swinging like it's a series of arguments, like I'm trying to pick a fight with somebody. And I don't think I am. And I think a lot of this book is a self-interrogation, because particularly that moment that you mentioned where it's me and my buddy, we're teenagers, he's just gotten his driver's license, we're driving around and we see this like very slight fender bender where this man who was probably Pakistani or Indian comes out, and the man who I strongly suspect was a local, was a Qatari man, comes out and starts beating him, like starts physically assaulting this man over a minor fender bender. I was on board with that, right?
You were laughing.
I mean, the people driving past were lowering their windows and honking their horns and smiling and hooting. And we were fully on board with this idea that, yes, we live in a society where there's an underclass, and that is perfectly fine, and I don't have to think about it. And I come to this part of the world, and I'm effectively asked to partake in a similar deal. Where the hell are these fruits and vegetables in my grocery store coming from, and whose life is being made miserable to provide this? Well, just don't think about it. There is people whose non-existence is central to your privilege of daily existence. All you have to do is not think about them. All you have to do is look away. And when I was living in Qatar, I mean, granted, I was a teenager, but I fully bought in. But yeah, that's just the way these things work. And I think about that now because it shaped me to a large extent. I worked that muscle to the point that it was very powerful, that I could look away from almost anything, that I could normalize almost anything. And in trying to correct that, and to be honest, mostly failing because it was so ingrained for so long, that has come to be how I think about any society now. I don't care about your GDP. I don't care about the standard markers of quality of life. Those are all fantastic. More power to you. Whose non-existence is central to this project? And I've asked that about every society I've been a part of, every society I've ever looked at since that point. Because not only does it happen everywhere to certain degrees, it is so easy to normalize. I mean, you know this, you've been there. Life in a place like Qatar, if you sign that deal to look away, is one of the easiest lives you will ever have. Incredible comfort, incredible wealth, all the rest of it. And I don't know that that's super far removed from the deal I sign over here, where my grocery store's shelves are fully stocked and there's a certain ease of life that is part and parcel of me not thinking about the people who make this happen. That's just come. It's a very minor incident in the grand scheme of things, this minor fender bender in the streets of Doha one day. But it has heavily influenced how I think about the world ever since.
Well, it's of course how the Israelis looked at the Palestinian day workers when they were allowed to go into Israel and build their houses and do other menial work. You write about the press, and you write quite pressingly about the press. There's one little passage I want to read and then have you comment on. And we were both journalists. More than a few of my former colleagues in the aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the Hamas attacks on Israel proudly boasted of their support for both Ukraine and Israel. When Russian authorities detained and eventually convicted Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gerskovich, who has since been released, in an obvious sham of a judicial process, almost every Western media outlet called it what it was. But as the Israeli military wiped out both Palestinian journalists and their entire families in a deliberate campaign to silence the flow of information out of Gaza, virtually all the same colleagues, all the same outlets, took a very different approach. The profession of journalism necessitates a capacity to understand things, and all who watched the killings understood what was happening. The press has played such a shameful role in all of this. Just comment a little bit on that incredible duplicity.
Yeah, I was a journalist for 10 years. I covered all kinds of different beats and I was all over the place. And I think one of the facets of journalism that is somewhat difficult to get across is that journalism demands, or at least journalism in the sort of corporate environment or an institutional environment, demands two almost directly contradictory things. I mean, I was a journalist in Canada where we have something called the Michener Award. And the Michener Award is widely regarded as sort of the highest award for journalism in the country. And it's very much predicated on the idea of public service, which is to say journalism that causes institutional change. You know, there were some amazing pieces of journalism that caused, for example, a lot of our police forces to completely re-examine how they deal with sexual assault cases. And that was the result of work done by a reporter named Robin Doolittle. It was an incredible piece of journalism. But I don't know how somebody looks at that and doesn't see a measure of activism. You have to believe in something. You have to believe that you are in this to cause positive change. And yet there is a part of the spectrum where the switch can be flipped. And suddenly you have to be sort of capital O objective and neutral.